I'm glad for liberty just as an American, just here. But how many of us are glad for our peace and our freedom in Christ? And that's an eternal, that's huge. I mean, that's the difference of life. And I think if we would pull somebody out of jail this morning and say, you've just been given freedom, like, we get used to freedom, we get used to liberty. And take you back about 154 years. Okay, so how many of you like Civil War history? And I know this doesn't have to do so much just with our freedom today, but Battle of Gettysburg, day three. Okay, so Battle of Gettysburg, day three, and it was probably the highest point of the Confederacy. And some of you could say a lot more about this than I can. I mean, as far as just the history of it. But when you start talking freedom and cost, and we have a country, and there's always, when we talk about our liberty and our peace with God, and we ask Jesus what it cost, he can tell us what it cost. Like, there's a cost. Day three, so there came a time, and it probably wasn't the best decision Robert E. Lee ever made. Great general, as far as a Southern general, one of the best. And he decided to try to divide the Union. The Union had the hill, and so there's 15,000 men decided to charge this hill. And the reason I say this, and there's people, you can correct, I'm good. I think I'm pretty close here. But the one thing that happened, they had to cross about a mile and a half of open territory, and they bombarded this hill. They shot over a lot of it, not knowing they shot over a lot of it. They thought they had taken out more of the Union than they did. But they had about a mile and a half to cross across this open place in Gettysburg. And it was a pretty significant battle in the Civil War. But what did happen is, as they went out, and the casualties were heavy, heavy, heavy. But the commitment of the Confederate soldiers at this time is they kept rank. As one group of men was shot down, more men fell in place, and they kept walking across this field. It was intense. But if you ask those men what it meant to them, they could tell you their idea and what they were fighting for and what it cost. Heavy. So I'm just going to leave that. Liberty never comes free. Liberty never comes free. Not as we sit here at peace with our God. It came at a high cost. And Jesus took my debts, my sin. And he paid it. And I'm gonna just leave that. I didn't not here to. So there's been a lot of change in the past week and a half. I've been in the office quite a bit, and I thought about this, that like in the last year and a half, I don't know that I ever remember a year and a half of my life that has been this much constant change or unsteadiness. I mean, Since March of last year, our world has it just keeps changing. Like there's ever change. And I guess the message that I have today is more about the constancy of God and the timelessness of God and how God's never in a hurry. God doesn't get in a hurry. He doesn't get in a hurry. And so I'm going to go back. It's familiar territory. But I'd like to ask you a question in the middle of this. So you may want to pay attention, because I'm going to specifically ask a few of you to answer this question. But I want you to answer it if you were God. If you were God, what would you do that makes sense? And none of us are God. So there's no, okay. So I'm going to just jump in here and keep rolling. Genesis 1-5 very quickly talks about creation, Adam's family. Genesis 1-5, so it's just five chapters in, we get to the flood. Genesis 6-9 is the flood and kind of the after. By Genesis 9, 9 chapters in the Bible, we're at the rainbow. By chapter 11 in Genesis, I mean the whole book of the Bible, by chapter 11, we already find Abraham and his dad Terah. So just right there at the beginning, Terah in Ur of the Chaldees, and he left Ur, said he was headed for Canaan, but he stopped at Haran. So this is a picture of Ur of the Chaldees back then, okay? Because I don't know what you think about when you think about Abraham's dad leaving Ur of the Chaldees. History would tell us it was a place of beauty, graced with towers, palaces, temples, law courts, market squares, statues, shrines, gardens, rectangular city blocks, paved street, two-story houses, had its own seaport, man-made canal, bustling commercial center. Is that what you thought of when you thought of Ur of the Chaldees? This is Abraham's dead. 100,000 people, give or take, lots of idols. This is 11 chapters into the Bible. This is not long after the flood. The route they took to leave Ur would have been a well-patrolled, busy thoroughfare, traveling with people that enjoyed, the people would have been people that enjoyed music, painting, sculpture, poems, plays. The most likely route they would have taken would have been to southern Mesopotamia, which would be present-day Iraq, would have been the west bank of the Euphrates, and it's about a 700-mile trip to Haran. So this is maybe a little different than what I would have pictured as they left Ur. So they were headed for Canaan, stopped in Haran, and settled there. And Abram's dad passed away there. He was 205 years old. And right away, God started speaking to Abram again. Genesis 12, one chapter later, God talks to Abraham, and God's up to something here. He says, Abraham, leave your native country, leave your relatives, your father's family, and go to the land I will show you. I will make you a great nation. I will bless you and make you famous, and you will be a blessing to others. I will bless those who bless you and curse those who treat you with contempt. All the families on earth will be blessed through you. That's a huge, God's speaking quite a bit when he says that. How many of us would like if God would just personally tell us, all the families on the earth will be blessed through you. I will bless those who bless you, Sean. I will curse those who curse you. So you want to pull up Genesis 12, Stephen up here. Genesis 12, 4 to 9. It's interesting how quickly, like, he went. When he got there, he built an altar. From there, he went off toward the hills east of Bethel and pitched his tent with Bethel on the west and Ai on the east. There he built an altar to the Lord. Again, built an altar and called on the name of the Lord. Then Abram set out and continued toward the Negev. And I'm going to read verse 10. And come back to it, but it changes right there. Now there was a famine in the land, and Abram went down to Egypt. After he got to Canaan, he went to Egypt to live there for a while because the famine was severe. And very quickly, again, God said, go, and Abram went. And we know that he didn't totally know where he was going when he went, but he went. How many of us are willing to go when the Lord says, go, not knowing where he went? The area was inhabited by Canaanites. So this is, just think through that. So this is Canaan. This is the promised land, but it's inhabited by Canaanites already. And verse 10 says there was a famine. So it's kind of interesting because it says that he went down and lived as a foreigner. What was Abraham in Canaan at this time? Like, he had just came there, but that was what was promised to him. So he went down to Egypt and lived as a foreigner. What was Abraham to God when he was in Egypt? What was he when he was in Canaan? But like, there's a part of it, how quickly the promises of God. Canaan was home, even though he'd come so far, but now he was away from home again in Canaan. So they became wealthy there in Egypt, and they came back to Canaan, and it says they came back and they had stuff with them. So people, herds, flocks, and they came back, and they remember where they came to the place there, and God said, this land, you take it. And Abraham and Lot were traveling together, and they had too much to go to one place. So Abraham told Lot, you pick, you take your pick. And he picked the Jordan Valley, fertile, lush, and it was close to Sodom and Gomorrah. And we know how that ended. Not good. Didn't end good at all. But Abraham took the higher country. And Genesis 13, 15 to 18, and kind of keep this God question in your mind. But this is what the Lord told Abraham. Look as far as you can see in every direction, north, south, east, and west. I am giving this land to you as far as you can see, to you and your descendants as a permanent possession. I will give you so many descendants that like the dust of the earth, they cannot be counted. Go and walk through this land in every direction, for I am giving it to you. And again, Abraham built an altar. Like, God is just speaking this stuff. I will give you this land. We find Abram there. God wasn't done with his promises. The Lord spoke to him, don't be afraid, Abraham. I will protect you, and your reward will be great. And we find this. And when Abraham said, when God told Abraham this, he had a reply. And it was a reply we would have made, I think. Abraham said, that's nice. And you talk about descendants. He said, I don't even have a son. He said, like, how does this all work? And like, no son. God took Abram outside and said to him, look up in the sky, count the stars if you can. That's how many descendants you will have. Look at the stars. That's your descendants. Genesis 15:6, and Abram believed the Lord, and the Lord counted him as righteous because of his faith. Hebrews 11:10 in the NLT, Abraham was confidently looking forward to a city with eternal foundations, a city designed and built by God. So just kind of basic stuff. How did God use the nation Israel in the Old Testament? So this isn't the God question, but what do we know? And can you help me here? And there's not just one right answer, but I would like you guys to answer this question. How did God use the nation Israel in the Old Testament in the world? Like, what did he do with Israel? What all did he do with that? And just... it's okay. There's different angles to this. So if you could help me, I'd like to hear from you. How did God use the nation Israel in the Old Testament? What did he do through Israel? How all? What all? Some of you guys were just at EBI, so you guys better start talking, even if you're visitors. How did... God showed the world his power. Other things about how he used Israel. kind of interesting. God wanted to be known, and he used a lot of ways. He used the nation Israel to show things about himself to the world. It's, yeah. These are all things. That's exactly right, because God did so much, and there's not just one right answer. This is all part of, like, God did so much with the nation Israel. A couple other things yet, and none of everything we've got so far is all right there in line with all of it. None of it's more important than the other. He gave us. It's interesting how much the prophecy and the just all of that and the long hand of God was revealed in that, and leading up to the culmination there of Jesus. And we were given the law there through the Israelites. Like, we understand a lot about God through that. We understand some of our sin. We know the glory of God was revealed through the power, like this different, what was it, Queen of Sheba? I mean, because it talks about how she came and saw. That was kind of at a high point of Israel, David, Solomon, but even just the personal stories of the people involved, like we learn a lot from Moses, David, and I mean, it's on and on, so it was just a lot. God was revealing himself, his ways, his power, his glory, and he used Israel a lot. And there's still something about this land of Canaan. Genesis 15, the Lord covenanted with Abraham. I've given this land to your descendants all the way from the border of Egypt to the great Euphrates River. And Eric referenced some of this in Sunday school. I've given this land to your descendants all the way from the border of Egypt to the great Euphrates River, the land now occupied. So when God gave this to Abraham, he recognized that it was occupied by the Kenites, Kenizzites, Kadmonites, Hittites, Perizzites, Rephites, Ammonites, Canaanites, Girgashites, Jebusites. God has a man, he has a people, he's chosen a land for these people to occupy that are not occupied by a lot of other people. So this is the question that's now your God question, okay? So you got a place. You have this grand plan that you're going to show your power, your glory. You're going to teach the world about yourself. And you have this place, and you have a people. Like he said, Abraham, it's going to be through your descendants. Now, how, and we can read how Abraham, like it was in that time that the people came and took Lot, and Abraham was wealthy. So I think he had 318 soldiers. Just, I mean, kind of interesting, but he had 318 soldiers, and he went after them, chased them down, brought them back. And remember what king, like where there was a tithe and a blessing, King Melchizedek. So this was right in that time. And how many of you would like to receive a blessing from an earthly, the King Melchizedek? I would. There's something about that. But 318 soldiers, but you have a land, you have a promise, you have a people. how do you take this and become this great nation? Like, how do you get there? So how would you, if you were God, take Abraham and this group of people? What would be your progression to make this a great nation? So I'd like to hear, how would you take Abraham and his family and herds and flocks, 318 soldiers, and how would you build the nation Israel? Let's not reference what God did. Let's just think, how would we do? How would you get from Abraham, a traveler, a settler, 318 men? What would be your timetable? Any input? Anybody? You're not going to be right as far as being with how God did it unless you just go, like, but how would you build that? I think it's interesting because of how much change is happening in our world. And we think timetable and how God gets from one place to another place, and we look at how he's done in history and times past, and you go, God, how did you do that? How would you build this nation? Okay, so I'm going to be quiet until I have a few people give an answer. Somebody on that row. So you guys fight amongst each other there. On your row, Joey, one of you guys give an answer and somebody else. How does God get from there to the great nation Israel? If you were God, how would you do this? I think I would too do that. Anybody else? Any thoughts there? About 40 sons. But it would make sense if he would settle somewhere and the men they have, that they start winning little battles, right? And then they win bigger battles and you create a little more territory, and with time you become more powerful and you take more territory. The one thing that's kind of interesting like this, and this is where this great promise and God's great power, and the one thing that he did with Abraham is he checked him again. He said, Abraham, go sacrifice your son. And he meant it. Like he was testing. So all this promise, and he wanted to know if Abraham trusted him or trusted in what he promised. And that's true. There'll be days in our lives where everything that God has promised to you, he may call back in and ask you to lay it down just to know if you're okay with him. He did it to Abraham here. Does God lack resources? No. God doesn't lack resources. He didn't then, and he doesn't today. Does God lack ability? He didn't then, he doesn't today. And just for sake of seeing what God did, how would you have accomplished it? God's power, his glory. How long would you have waited for this to become fruition? Like if your heart is that the world may know you, may know your glory, may see your power, may worship, how long would you wait to make that play out? How would you build an army? The other thing is, would you let the enemy get stronger? Like if Canaan was established and there was things there, and I guess I say that because our world changes. And at this point, there was already established enemy in Canaan. And would God let the enemy get stronger? Would he let evil become worse? Would he let the cities become more walled, greater, thicker? Would he let giants be born and giants become big giants? Genesis 15, the Lord said to Abraham, this isn't the NLT, you can be sure, this is right in the middle of all this promise, right in the middle of all this promise. He said, you can be sure that your descendants will be strangers in a foreign land where they will be oppressed as slaves. They will be there 400 years. You can be sure of that, Abraham. 400 years is a long time. Christopher Columbus hit this ground 1492. William Tyndale, he was in the early 1500s. If you want to be about, we're probably within a year of 400 years when pilgrims hit Plymouth Rock. November 11th, 1620, 400 years ago. 400 years is a long time. Like, we think the last year and a half, we think God better show up. We think the changes are happening fast. They're out of control. I mean, I'm not saying that. My point is 400 years in the middle of this promise, in the middle of this land, in the middle of all this, God said 400 years. He said, they'll be there. Pilgrims, just a side note, just when I looked at the date, one thing that was kind of interesting, when the pilgrims hit Plymouth Rock, they were still out in the harbor. They read Psalms 100. Make a joyful noise unto the Lord, all ye lands. Serve the Lord with gladness. Come before his presence of the Lord with singing. Know ye that the Lord, he is God. God continued speaking. I will punish the nation that enslaved them, and they, in the end they will come away. And he was talking about the children of Israel. They will come away with great wealth. God had a plan, 400 years. After four generations, your descendants will return here to this land. And then God says something that's kind of interesting. He says, for the sins of the Amorites do not yet warrant their destruction. So there's something about the mercy and the justice of God that even in this plan, even in all of this, that God allowed evil to go on. And he said, for the sins of the people of the Amorites do not yet warrant their destruction. And some things we see in God's action then, and I guess it's the question, does he have a plan today? He had a plan. He wasn't in a hurry, as we understand it. He actually was okay that people had choice, and it was going to get worse. He did bring judgment when they deserved it. So, I mean, merciful and just. He was okay. I don't know if you're okay with that, but he was okay that Abraham's descendants would be enslaved and become slaves, and not just one generation, generational slavery. He allowed them to leave Egypt and into bondage, so they were not only slaves but foreigners. He allowed them to become dependent on Egypt's rule, but also the Egyptians' giving. He allowed the walled cities in Canaan to become stronger, greater. He allowed giants to be born. Even while the Israelites were slaves, he allowed Canaan to be lush and flourishing. I guess kind of interesting. Like, even as the children were slaves and working and sweating, Canaan was lush and flourishing under Canaanite rule. He allowed the Egyptians to kill the babies of the Hebrews. And I don't know exactly what all, but it's in there. He allowed Moses to be trained in the Egyptian palace. And if you want to go further, God sent Joseph to Egypt, which ultimately took the children of Israel to Egypt. God sent him ahead. Like, you want to see the long play of the hand of God? He allowed Joseph and his brothers to take Jacob's body back to Canaan and bury his dead. So the land of promise was still there in there. Like, it was still a part of them. Joseph's bones were carried. He made them promise to take his bones. Did God have more resources 430 years later? Were the Canaanites weaker? Didn't the Israelites go from Abraham being wealthy and having fighting men and being in control to them being a nation of slaves, very dependent on Egypt? Did it make any sense? Does God work on our timetable? Exodus 12:41, it says, when the Israelites had been in Egypt 430 years, Exodus 12:41 says, in fact, it was the last day of the 430th year that all of the Lord's forces left the land. On this night, the Lord kept his promise to bring his people out of the land of Egypt. So this night belongs to him. On time, commemorated. He says, commemorate year after year, generation after generation. This was the Lord's side of the equation. 430 years later, he brought a people, a nation of slaves. And as they left, they were showered with wealth. 600,000 men, women, and children. And they weren't like, this was a traveling group. The plagues, the Red Sea, Mount Sinai, the clouds came to the land of Canaan. Laws, procedure, ceremony, tabernacle, worship. And I guess I'm gonna make this last part fast. I mean, it's time to get out of here. But this, when they came and it was time to go into the land, when it was 430 years later, he brought this people back and he says, now it's time to go in. It's time to go and occupy. And there was walls and there was cities and there was giants, and they sent the 12 men in. And they came back, and Joshua and Caleb said, let's go. He said, it's lush, it's good, there's giants, we can do this, God's on our side. 10 men, and remember, and I guess I want you to think about where you're at, 2021, and everything that's changed right around us. Are you good if the walls have got a little bigger, if the giants are good? Are you good? Is God in control? Is he out of control? Does God have places for you to go? And I think there's people my age here and older, and like, we have things, we have giants and walls. I think the reality is there's a lot of, and there's plenty of you that have giants ahead of you. There's plenty of you that have walled cities ahead of you. Like, honestly, they came to that place, and the people that had fear in their hearts never made it into the land of Canaan. They didn't make it in, because they came up, the people complained, said, we can't do this, God, you're not big enough, you can't do this. And God was like, I'm going to wipe them off. And he didn't. He let them, gave them 40 years, but they died in the wilderness. I don't want to die in the wilderness. Like, I want to embrace that what God has in the hand of God and what's ahead of us, that it is in God's, under his power, it's under his resources. Jesus is building his church. He is. It's not a question of will it happen. It will happen. And sometimes I think there's as much question if, have I left Egypt? Am I traveling with God? But in that, the things, the places, do I embrace the greatness and the power and the rule of God without letting fear? And that's true for me. It's changes. There is changes. You want to pull up the last one there, Stephen? God doesn't lack resources. God doesn't do stuff to our timetable. God is not scared of it getting worse. He gives choice to humankind. He is merciful and just. God will judge the world. Scripture would tell us every knee will bow. God isn't scared or won't hesitate to put or allow his children to go to hard places to accomplish. God uses faith. That's one thing. Let's not lose sight of the people that didn't believe, didn't have faith. God didn't use them forward. God still doesn't like when we doubt him. He isn't dependent on our understanding of how it makes sense and what he allows in world government. God does things on his timetable, his way. God's not scared of giants or walls or walled city. To him, it's only opportunity for glory. It's always been like that. He doesn't look at the size. He doesn't, like, God will be glorified. He will be bowed down to, and it's just going to be how and when. God uses people that are willing to take on giants and walled cities and move ahead. And often he doesn't use those who cower in fear. And sometimes we move with fear, but cower. The go is still in effect. The occupy, show forth his glory. America, this is no surprise to God. He's not surprised. He's a long play God. He always was. Second Corinthians 10:3, for though we walk in the flesh, we do not war after the flesh, for the weapons of our warfare are not carnal, but mighty through God to the pulling down of strongholds, casting down imaginations and every high thing that exalteth itself against the knowledge of God, and bringing into captivity every thought the obedience of Christ. The world is unprincipled. The world doesn't fight fear. It's a paraphrase. We don't live our lives that way, never have and never will. The tools of our trade aren't for marketing or manipulation, but they are for taking down that entirely massively corrupt culture. We use our powerful God tools for smashing warped philosophies, tearing down barriers against the truth of God, fitting every loose thought and emotion and impulse into the structure of a life shaped by Christ. But it's the reality that all things will come into the reign and the rule of Christ. And we don't have to fight everything. And yet we do have to stand in. And building lives of obedience. So just interesting. You want to go to the next one there? And I'll close with this. It came to pass when Joshua was by Jericho that he lifted his eyes and looked, and behold, a man stood opposite him with his sword drawn in his hand. Joshua went to him and said to him, are you for us or for our adversaries? And the thing that's just interesting about that, this land was promised to Abraham 400 some years before. 400 some years before. And the children of Israel are finally getting here after the 40 years. And he asks, are you friend or foe? But we can rest assured as we walk in obedience to Jesus. Joshua went to him and said to him, are you for us or for our adversaries? So he said, no, but as commander of the army of the Lord, I have now come. Joshua fell on his face to the earth and worshipped and said to him, what does my Lord say to his servant? The commander of the Lord's army said to Joshua, take your sandals off your foot, for the place where you stand is holy. It always was. It was God's territory even back then. Like, they finally made it. As we live our lives, let's just not let fear change. Let's keep God on the throne. And if there's giants that have your name on them, then take out the giants with your name on them, because that's what we're supposed to do. And that's how we're supposed to live. And let's just stand. Marcus, you want to dismiss us with prayer?